Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as Pope Benedict meets with the Jesuits holding their general congregation here in Rome, we take a close look at the challenges the order is facing over the coming years. And in the footsteps of Pope John Paul II, one Vatican cardinal travels to Cuba as another meets with Muslim scholars at Cairo's Al-Azhar University. Pope Benedict met on Thursday with members of the General Congregation of the Jesuits, which has been meeting here in Rome for the past 6 weeks. Greeting the new head of the order, Father Adolfo Nicolas, and his assistants, the Pope urged the Jesuits to rediscover that missionary zeal which has borne such extraordinary fruits for the Church over the past 4.5 centuries. My colleague Emma McCarthy reports on what the Pope had to say.
La Chiesa ha bisogno di voi.
Pope Benedict XVI told the Jesuit priests gathered before him Thursday, the Church needs you, it counts on you, and continues to trust in you to reach those physical and spiritual places where others fail to or have difficulty in reaching.
I temi oggi continuamente discussi e messi in questione.
The Holy Father said that on the one hand there is a world that is a theatre where the battle between good and evil is waged, an evil that hides behind the individualism of ideas which relativize the sacred, an evil that is propagated through a confusion of messages which make it increasingly difficult to hear Christ's message, an evil which lies within those situations of injustice and conflict of which the poorest are the victims. On the other hand, he said, there is a religious order which in the course of its 500-year history has been capable of challenging cultural and historical adversities to bring the true gospel to all corners of the world. Today, noted the Pope, the obstacles challenging those who announce the gospel are no longer seas and vast distances. Rather, they are the boundaries of a superficial vision of God and of man, which places obstacles in the way of faith and human knowledge, faith and science, faith and the commitment to justice. Faced with these boundaries, continued Pope Benedict, Jesuits must be witnesses and help create the understanding that there is instead true harmony between faith and reason, a harmony that must be translated into the defence of those central issues which today are increasingly under attack from secular culture, in short, marriage and the family, sexual morality, and the question of mankind's salvation in Christ.
Proprio per questo vi ho invitato e vi invito anche oggi a riflettere.
Here the Pope invited the Jesuits to renewed reflection on the meaning of their characteristic fourth vow of obedience to St. Peter's successor, which he said does not only imply readiness to be sent out on missions to far-off lands, but also, in true Ignatian spirit, to feel themselves with the Church and in the Church, to love and serve Christ's vicar as precious and irreplaceable collaborators at the service of the universal Church.
And my thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's meeting with the Jesuits on Thursday morning. Altogether, 225 delegates have been attending this 35th General Congregation of the Jesuits, which began on January the 7th with the primary task of electing a new head of the order. Father Adolfo Nicolas was chosen on January 19th as the best man suited to lead the Society of Jesus, following the 25-year service of outgoing Superior General Father Peter Hans Kolvenbach.
As you probably know, generals of the Society of Jesus are appointed for life. It's only where there are grave reasons that a general may offer his resignation. And Father Kolvenbach did this with the approval of the Holy Father after nearly 25 years as general.
Though there is little information available about the contents of these meetings, the former head of the British province of Jesuits, Father David Smolira, spoke with journalists earlier this month to share his experience of the election process and the ensuing phase of defining issues that will shape the order over the coming years.
I think it's probably worth just sharing with you a few of my own reflections of my experience of the election process, because it was really, I tried to think of the best word to describe it, but it was really awe-inspiring for me. When we gather together to begin those 4 days, there are no formal candidates at the beginning of the process, and there's no campaigning that takes place. In fact, we're specifically forbidden from any sort of ambitioning to become general. So there's an atmosphere which is a very much of a collaborative atmosphere. And as we talked and reflected and prayed together, names gradually begin to surface, begin to emerge. And then, very much under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, the members of the general congregation gradually come to the point where they're ready to make their votes at the election. Father Nicholas was elected on the second ballot, and then after that election, the Holy Father was informed, and then the results of the election announced. Once the election process was over, the general congregation moved into the next phase, where it considers matters of importance for Jesuit life and for our mission. Much of the initial work that we do in this phase of the congregation is being done in small groups that are then reported back to the aula where we're all gathered together. The main themes that we have looked at first have been four. They've been on Jesuit identity and mission. So looking at what it means to be a Jesuit today and reading the signs of the times in the world and saying, what is it that the Society of Jesus should be doing? The second area is on obedience, to look at how we live out our vow of obedience in today's world with all of the challenges that we face in that regard, and also particularly how we live out our special vow of obedience to the Holy Father. Thirdly, we're looking at government structures. That's the governance structures within the society. In the globalized world in which we live now, it's very important the society acts in a coordinated way. And some of the structures that we have perhaps don't facilitate that in the best way that we could. So we're looking at inter-provincial cooperation and how groups of provinces can cooperate more effectively together, and so how we can be most effective in the international work of the society in this globalized world. And then fourthly, we're looking at collaboration with others. So how do we best work with all of the range of partners in ministry that we have? How do we make decisions with them? How do we use them as a resource? How do we serve them best? How do we train them best? And how do we train Jesuits to work most effectively with others? So those are the four main areas that we've been talking about first of all, and it's quite likely that those four topics will lead towards decrees. At the end of a general congregation, we produce a number of decrees which are intended primarily for the society, for all of the Jesuits throughout the world, but also, obviously, these are often read by others as well. What we've now embarked upon, having got that process underway with those four topics, four main themes, are having a range of discussions on other topics of importance to the Society of Jesus. And these are, or at least some of them are, community life, how we Jesuits live together, formation and training, how we train Jesuits, vocations, how we attract people to join the society. So those are some of the concerns about sort of internal matters in the society. And then other matters of concern with regard to the apostolate, particularly migrants and the movement of people, youth, religious fundamentalism, and particularly the work of Africa, the work of the Jesuits in Africa and in China, to what are called apostolic preferences, priorities for the society in terms of our work. Two other topics that we also have looked at or will be looking at our globalization, which I've already mentioned, and then the whole area of ecology and the environment, the stewardship of creation.
In all of these important areas, Jesuits seek to follow the ideals laid down by their founder, Saint Ignatius of Loyola, as they struggle with the challenges in the different countries where they live and work. Despite the rapidly changing societies and the new difficulties they face, Father David says the Jesuits are constantly called to bring their specific charism of responding to the signs of the times.
Well, I think one of the characteristics of the Society of Jesus throughout its history is to read the signs of the times, and that's a very important aspect of our charism, to be able to look around us and say, what does the world need, what does the church need from the society now? And I think one of the challenges that comes along with doing that is that if we're very sensitive, and I hope we are, to what we see and hear around us, that has an impact on us. It's a dialogical process. And so we need to re-understand ourselves and who we are in every age, at every time, so that we can authentically live out our charism, but to do it very much in the world of today. Some of the other traditions within the church, monastic traditions, for example, have a different way of doing that, that they have an established rule, which we don't have, and they live out that rule within the confines of their monastery. And in some ways, the expression of their life is within that context. We don't have monastery walls. Our arena is the world, and we're in a rapidly changing world. And I think you probably know from your own experience and the experience of your contemporaries that the world shapes who you are as well as you shaping the world. And so we have to attend to who we are as well as what we do in that world. And I think that is authentically following the Jesuit charism, the Jesuit tradition.
Today, the Society of Jesus numbers around 19,000 members worldwide, though the problem of new vocations, especially in Western countries, remains a crucial challenge for the Jesuits, as it does for most other religious congregations.
It's certainly true that vocations to the Society of Jesus, numbers of people joining, are in some areas of the world significantly reducing. It's also true that in some areas of the world they are significantly increasing, particularly in South and East Asia, but also in Africa. So there are large numbers of Jesuits, large numbers of people joining the Jesuits in some areas of the world. But I think what the congregation is doing at the moment in looking at the issue of vocations is precisely saying, well, what is it that we can do to attract people to join us? What is it we can do, not simply to attract them to join, but also how can we best form them, train them, to be available for the mission of the society in the future? It's if you look at Western Europe or the Western world in general, the idea of a lifetime commitment is quite a challenge for most young people, not just in the area of religious life, but in the area of marriage and in all sorts of other areas. So I think what we're trying to do is to look at the world, to look at the situation of contemporary culture in which young people find themselves, and say, how can we address those issues and attract people and then deal with their formation in the most effective way possible? I don't think we're coming up at this stage with any particular magical answers, but I think we're looking seriously at the questions and seeing how we can do it better.
Father David Smolyra, their former head of the British province of Jesuits, addressing journalists during the 35th General Congregation of the Order, which is currently going on here in Rome. Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone is in Cuba this week, marking the 10th anniversary of Pope John Paul's historic visit to the Caribbean island nation. Speaking on the eve of his departure, the Cardinal described Vatican-Cuban relations as relatively good and said the church in Cuba enjoys great vitality, despite what he called the known difficulties, such as getting its voice heard in the media, bringing in foreign clergy, and obtaining freedom for religious education. The Cardinal arrived in Havana on Wednesday, the day the ailing Cuban president Fidel Castro officially resigned after nearly half a century as the country's communist leader. Although Cuba was officially declared an atheist nation, the government never broke off relations with the Holy See, and in 1998, Castro himself was on hand to welcome Pope John Paul on his historic pilgrimage. Cardinal Bertone is scheduled to meet with the country's foreign minister, as well as with Cuba's bishops, priests, seminarians and faithful, before returning to Rome on February the 26th. Meanwhile, the Vatican's top official for dialogue with the Muslim world heads to Cairo this weekend. His visit marks the anniversary of Pope John Paul's trip to Egypt in the year 2000. During that pilgrimage to the places marking the Christian history of salvation, the late Pope prayed at the foot of Mount Sinai, but also stressed the need for dialogue with followers of other monotheistic religions at a meeting in Cairo's Al-Azhar University, one of the most important centres of learning in the Islamic world. Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, is leading the Holy See's delegation for this annual meeting at Al-Azhar, which is an important point of reference for Islamic scholars throughout the world. Accompanying Cardinal Torrent for the meeting on Monday and Tuesday is Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, himself a former head of the Pontifical Council and currently the Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and the Arab League.
Well, the essential meeting is a meeting of the Joint Committee of Al-Azhar, the Committee for Dialogue with Monotheistic Religions of Al-Azhar, and the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue in the Vatican. This committee was set up in 1998 and has been meeting yearly since that time. So this is the 10th anniversary, in fact, of the setting up of this joint committee. And the Muslim partners asked that the meeting should take place on the anniversary of the visit of John Paul II to Al-Azhar in the year 2000, when he was going in the footsteps of Moses. He put this visit on his program, and it took place actually on the 24th of February, but that is a Sunday this year, and so the meeting has been put to the 25th and 26th.
As you say, it is marking the 10th anniversary of the start of this particular dialogue. If you could perhaps put your finger on what have really been the fruits of this dialogue, if you could say what progress perhaps there has been over this decade.
The fruits are not very visible as yet, I would say. You know, it takes a long time, you know, to build up relations. And also the people have changed, both in the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Cardinal Torrent is the new president, and he is coming as president for the first time to Cairo. But also in Al-Azhar, there has been almost a complete change. Certainly at the top, there's been a complete change of the committee. So in a sense, it's a new beginning. But there have been some declarations that have been made, condemnations of violence, for instance, together, which I think were important in the time. The insistence on a certain amount of self-criticism in religion, people of religion, that is, that, you know, that this indicates a degree of openness. There have been efforts in past meetings to widen out to a larger public On one occasion, when the delegation came from the Vatican, they were asked to appear on a popular program of Egyptian television, Good Morning Egypt, which is a very, you know, popular morning program. And there was a half-hour spot given to dialogue, which I think is very good to get this message across to many other people. And similarly, when the Al-Azhar delegation came to Rome, talks were given in different places. I remember a talk was given at the Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies. Again, that was perhaps a more select public than the Egyptian television, but it's the same idea, was to broadcast this news that Christians and Muslims are able to sit down together and to talk together reasonably and in a good spirit.
Would you say that that openness that you're talking about then reflects the climate there in Egypt? I mean, the situation is not always easy for Christians, though, is it?
It's certainly not easy for Christians. There are some signs of improvement. A new decision that was taken recently that Christians who had converted to Islam at one stage but have come back to Christianity can have this put down on their identity cards, because religion is indicated in the identity card, so they can indicate that they are Christians, though they have to say that they were for a time Muslims. But society is very different in Egypt, as in many other countries of the Islamic world. There are people who are very open to dialogue with Christians, there are, and people of other religions too. And there are people who are not at all in favor of such a dialogue and who would prefer that there be no contact with Christians, I think, really.
You mentioned this case of the Christians being allowed to return to their original faith. That's not likely to extend, though, is it, to Muslims who want to become Christians?
There has been a refusal of a rather prominent case of a man who has become a Christian and who has married a Christian and who wants his child to be registered as a Christian. And this has not been accepted. There's also the question of the Baha'i, whose situation is difficult, because they don't want to be classed either as, certainly not as Christians, and they don't want to be classed as Muslims either. Now, they're being allowed to leave this mention of religion blank on their identity cards. What will happen in the future, I don't know. There are people who are advocating that there be no mention of religion, but generally, society doesn't seem to be ready to accept that for the moment.
There is an increasing call for reciprocity as the basis of interreligious dialogue, isn't there? That Christians in Muslim countries should be allowed the same religious freedoms as Muslims can enjoy in Western or Christian countries. What do you see as the most important way of trying to push this forward, if you like?
I think you have to be, you know, quite sort of reasonable in this as well. There are, in most countries, Christians have the freedom to gather and to worship. Practically, it's only in Saudi Arabia that this is not possible. And so they do have their own buildings, and they are quite free within their own environment to do what they wish. But there are, of course, restrictions. One wonders which is the best way of going about acquiring a greater freedom, because sometimes the pushing of a hard line just makes people more reticent and not wanting interference from outside. I think there are, in many countries, there's a great susceptibility to criticism, and I would think that you would need to show that there is no danger here to society, that the more the people are free to express themselves, the better society will be. There's an interesting situation here with the Bible Society, which is recognized here and which has its own places, its own libraries, its own bookshops for selling the Bible and documents that and communication media that go around the Bible. And they've been told that as long as they do this openly, without any sort of subterfuge, any underhand methods, this is quite free. And so they are acting freely in society, which I think is interesting. And of course, there are also private religious television channels as well that are broadcasting their Christian channels.
We saw recently the exchange of letters, the Muslim scholars from around the world sending a letter to the Pope and other Christian leaders and a response from many of these people, from the Vatican, from the Archbishop of Canterbury and from other Protestant leaders. How would you say this has affected the climate, and what are the expectations from these talks in the light of this?
The topic that has been chosen for this meeting is very close to the concern of these Muslim scholars. The topic is faith in God and love of neighbor as the basis for a sound interreligious dialogue. And this corresponds to what the scholars had said in their document, in their letter to the Christian leaders, insisting on the love of God and the love of neighbor, which, of course, is something that we have in common and which is not often reflected in that way in Muslim writings. And so that is an interesting development, I think. One of the persons who signed this document is the Mufti of Egypt. He is not of Al-Azhar. This is a different office. But, I'm sure that people in Egyptian society will be looking at the development of this dialogue of the scholars with different Christian groups, and particularly perhaps with the forthcoming meeting with the Holy Father and the discussions that will take place in Rome.
The prospect of this dialogue has considerably raised expectations in some circles about a breakthrough, some kind of breakthrough in Christian-Muslim dialogue. Is that a realistic expectation, do you think?
Well, I think you have to understand that, interreligious dialogue is not the same as ecumenical dialogue. That ecumenical dialogue, we are trying to work together with the different churches and ecclesial communities to come to a common statement of the faith, and on the basis of which we will be able to be in communion with one another, in full communion. This, of course, is not the same with other religions, and in particular with Islam. We differ on the very basis. I mean, of course, we believe in one God, and we do have many things in common. But with regard to Jesus Christ, there is a fundamental difference, and we don't expect to have a common statement saying, oh, now we all agree together in our belief in Jesus Christ. So the expectations have to be different. I think that the expectations should be in the line of a greater acceptance of difference, which is very important, and yet at the same time of seeing areas where collaboration is possible. And there are many areas in which we can make progress, I think.
And my thanks there to Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, former head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue and currently the Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and the Arab League. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. But we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. Be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.